Welcome to Project Chatter, the podcast where PPM experts from various sectors talk about the latest trends. Listen to Val and Dale as they talk about tried and tested best practices and share their unfiltered thoughts about the industry. Whether you're here to learn how to progress your career, improve your project control skills, or just want to hear an Aussie and South African rant about projects, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Project Chatter podcast with your hosts, Dale Fung and Val Matthews.
This podcast is brought to you by Plan Academy. Plan Academy is the world's leading learning site for anyone working in construction project management or project controls.
At Plan Academy, you learn construction planning and scheduling theory, how to master scheduling software like Primavera P6, and even advanced construction scheduling techniques.
Plan Academy's courses are 100% online and at your own pace. You can learn at the office, at site, from home, anywhere. Check out planacademy.com today for free sample lessons and tons of free video.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by JustDo.com. JustDo is a great business and project management tool we've been using here at Project Chatter.
I agree, Val. I like to keep things simple and JustDo is perfect for that. But I do know it's got a lot of powerful functionality as well. And one of my favorites is the task-specific chat.
Absolutely. And for all you slackers, don't wait for Monday. Check out JustDo.com. Now on with the pod.
Hello, project people, and welcome to the Project Chatter podcast. I'm Val Matthews, and as always, I'm joined by my good man, Dale Fung.
How's it, folks? Hi, Val.
Hey, mate. In this episode, we get to speak to Tim Ackland. Hi, Tim. Great to have you on the show, mate.
Thanks, Val. It's going to be interesting.
It will be, with that moustache, for sure. On this pod, we'll be chatting to Tim about systems engineering versus project management. This is sure to be a heavyweight contest for sure. But before we get into that, here's Dale with Tim's bio.
Thanks, Val. So I hope all the listeners are buckled in and holding on tight to their seats for this bio. Just wait till you hear it. So let me gather my composure to take you through it. What a bio. So Tim grew up in Dorset, Scotland, Cornwall, Somerset, southern Belgium, and Bavaria, following the career path of his father, who was a UK Royal Navy helicopter pilot, later becoming a NATO instructor in crisis management. Tim found a keen interest in electronics at the age of around 12. After dismantling several family members' gadgets, he thought he better learn how to make them work again. After a natural affinity to physics and chemistry in secondary school, playing around with hobby electronics kits, theatrical lighting, and band amplification in his free time. Who plays with that in his free time? He eventually went to university to study electronics with French and German. This was a five-year degree with a focus on telecommunications and included a year at exchange universities in each of Germany and France. As well as having a great time, he managed to cover similar technical material 3 years in a row in three languages, resulting in a good familiarity of concepts from different perspectives, but a challenge of ever finding the right words to explain them. I can attest to how many words it takes Tim to get a concept across. So this is going to be a great, great pod. Tim's degree was a Master's of Engineering, which included study of the business of engineering, looking at economics, accountancy, legal aspects such as intellectual property and liability, statistics, and project management. Tim was lucky during his degree to get some very good work experience opportunities with hands-on placements at a range of design, manufacturing, and operation sites, including Motorola Research Labs in Paris, affiliated radio control system suppliers in the UK and Germany, and the Sky Digital Uplink Station near Southampton. On graduating, he had to adjust his career plan as the market was flooded with telecommunications engineers after the collapse of Nortel networks and the impact of the 3G licenses and infrastructure investment on the network operator's cash position. He fell into working with marine radar technology at a very interesting time of change in both technology and workforce generations. He had the luxury of gaining a huge amount of experience with little pressure and little progression through the hierarchy of his employer, working on a range of products. It was around this time that Tim had the pleasure of meeting and working obliquely with yours truly. The employer provided a one-year part-time course in systems engineering, led by the then director of professional development at the UK chapter of INCOSI, I think it's pronounced Tim, and we'll get into what that means. This was a great help in providing structure to Tim's otherwise chaotic attitudes to project success. After being thrown into a fairly stressful bid, another very good learning opportunity, he was offered a big leg up in progression by a competitor. It was clear that this move was going to be a big challenge for many reasons, but as an ex-rugby player, he decided to dive in headfirst. I love that, Tim. In the last 5 years, he has been involved as the technical figurehead in the sale of a UK business into a newly formed multinational defense electronics conglomerate, at least two reshuffles of business structure, and is being challenged to lead the strategy on a rapidly evolving product portfolio and supply chain of the UK business. Wow, I'm parched after that, Tim, but what an amazing, amazing bio. We got to start. Thanks. We got to start off though with that moustache. I mean, absolutely amazing. How long did it take to grow?
I forget. I think all of us under COVID are probably losing track of timescales, apart from maybe the project management team. I don't know. It's been a few months, and it's been a week since we went controversial.
Wow.
It doesn't look real.
It doesn't.
It's so perfect that it looks like you bought it at a shop and you just glued it on there.
Stuck it on. That's what I heard.
So married life's obviously treating him well. You know, he can let go of the looks on the face, facial hair side of things.
actually, my wife was the one that suggested a moustache. She didn't know what she was going to get when she when she put in the order.
Didn't specify.
She did specify, but you know, the order got mixed up in the mail.
Is that what you get from engineers, isn't it? Anyway, let's jump into it.
I told her it's one step along the way. It's just, you know.
brilliant. Love it. No, thanks, Tim. Really appreciate it. And as Val said, you know, we're going to jump into systems engineering versus project management. So I just want to, at the top of the pod, just let's draw a baseline, you know, because, you know, we're in projects. Baselines are great.
You love baselines.
We love baselines. For most of the listeners, we kind of have a fairly good understanding of what project management is. But I don't know if everyone really understands and appreciates what systems engineering is. If you gave us maybe your elevator pitch, so your 3 to 5 minute reel of what it is, what is systems engineering in a nutshell?
I think one of the challenges that you often have between the project management disciplines and actually delivering a project is somebody has to work out the technical aspects of the unknowns, the uncertainties, the risks. And not only do they have to work out where the risks are and what they are, what the unknowns and the uncertainties are, they have to work out opportunities for resolving those uncertainties and those risks. And frequently, as you guys will be aware and be familiar, there are a number of opportunities, there are a number of different ways to solve those problems or resolve those uncertainties. But the project manager, as an expert or a professional in actually managing, delivering, commenting on and steering the project, doesn't necessarily have the technical knowledge or the way to access the technical dialogue, the technical trade-offs that you have to deliver that particular project. And so somebody has to be the bridge between the engineering disciplines, and some of those are very intricate and very specific, and the actual project trade-offs in terms of what the risks are and how we're going to trade the risks and the costs and the schedules and the qualities and all of that trade-off. Somebody has to be the bridge. So systems engineering is very much the professional discipline of not just building up the experience and expertise of multidisciplinary engineering and dealing with multidisciplinary engineers, but also building up that playbook of skills, of techniques, of particular maneuvers that you can play, and being able to communicate them adequately and effectively to a wide range of engineering disciplines in the language that a wide range of engineering disciplines can follow, can engage with, and can negotiate with to a certain extent. And it's so if you can look at it as a hierarchy where the project management is frequently looking up and looking out in terms of the perspectives of the project, and the systems engineers are frequently looking downwards or inwards into the gearbox, the technical workings of the project. But there's very much an interface in both directions, and it's a team game. And without that glue, without that bridge, in my experience, you can really get stuck because there can be a big gap between technical experts and, as we would call in systems engineering, subject matter experts and project management disciplines. And so really that's where the systems engineering fits in as far as I'm concerned.
That's a great answer and very comprehensive. And no, it's great. It's great because I think a lot of people just understand, oh, you get project management and then you get engineering. And engineers are the doers and project management make sure they do things. But it's interesting you're saying there's actually a gap that needs bridging. And I mean, we're a bit provocative saying it's systems engineering versus project management, but it's not really versus, right? It's, as you say, it's bridging that gap. But what are some of the gaps and the challenges that systems engineering has to bridge in your typical experience? I don't know if there's the top five that you've come across in your career?
Well, the big stuff is the fact that subject matter experts spend a huge amount of their time going into the minutiae of solving particular technical problems in their particular disciplines and their particular angle. And from some of the experience that I've shared in my training with you, Dale, looking at the spectrum of disciplines or the spectrum of characteristics that an individual can have working within an organization. You have people who can be incredibly detailed and be quite narrow in their view. Mm. And then you have a number of other aspects of individuals in terms of their communication skills and their recognition of other angles of optimization, to be honest, in terms of respecting or recognizing that there is a trade-off between time, cost, and quality, for example, on the project management axis. And many engineers, particularly engineers who really want to solve a problem well, they struggle with trading those aspects off. They don't like the pressure, or pressure can cause an impact on the quality of delivery in a subject matter area. And to a certain extent, they really rely on having somebody else to handle those aspects for them within the engineering axis, to help them do those trade-offs, to help them make those decisions, and to help them look at the wider perspective and the wider piece from an engineering perspective, not just from a project perspective. And I think that's where the systems engineers fit in the engineering axis, is that they have a higher level view from the technical perspective of it, across a number of disciplines and across a number of trade-offs to help decisions be made in a more complex subsystem or system scenario.
Yeah, that's great. I'm not sure of the gap, but we can get into that in a sec. But I think the value of engineering is unquestionable. There is no project without the technical arm of the precision of engineering, the technical thought, the aspects of solving problems that arise from, particularly from ambiguous scope. The client sets out something and says, we want this to work in this way. And then the requirements come through to the engineering departments and then they say, what the hell? All right. So, and then you get these bespoke kind of make this round plug fit in that square hole kind of thing going on. And so for all the engineers that listen, you guys are critically important to the project process. And, you know, you are effectively delivering the product. The critical parts of the product come from the technical space. And I guess to summarize my view of project management and engineering real quickly, it's like the engineers are the doers, and I think the project managers are the movers. So they're always trying to push forward. And I think there should be a little bit of friction, because challenging ideas is important. And, you know, Dale and I have talked about it in other pods where you get this agreeableness happening. And generally, it's probably in the project management space, because they're talking to a lot of stakeholders and they'll agree to a time frame. They haven't consulted the technical experts or the system engineering team. You know, they haven't consulted anyone. And I'm not sure if it's completely their fault or the pressures of the project. Obviously, it is. But you get this agreeable frame at some level, and then that kind of trickles down. And it's not, you know, that obviously puts an unfair pressure onto the engineers who are trying to do the best they can with what they've got. And a lot of the time, it's not their issue as well. From your perspective, though, do you think, because I see project management and engineering as harmonious kind of crafts that work together within that, not the iron triangle, but something similar to that, the people, process, and tools, because most of project management, if you think about it, is a lot of herding cats and then explaining why you herded the cats in the first place and then explain why you got cats, you know. So from your perspective, do you see these two disciplines as harmonious, or do you think there's some unfair advantage, or do you think there's an opportunity to perhaps have some middle players in there, and how could we resolve that?
I think for those of us that work in well-functioning organizations, who've delivered successful projects, we can remember back to those moments of celebration or satisfaction when a project has been delivered well, and the engineers from the engineering apprentice all the way up through to the chief engineer to the technical director and the project managers are in the same room, smiling at each other, shaking hands and saying a job well done. So I think we all know, and we've all seen those times when success has occurred and everyone realizes that they work well and harmoniously together when things are working well. But I think I also respect what you say about sometimes a necessary friction. And I really enjoy the sparring that goes on in some of the projects that some of the more challenging projects that I've worked on early on in the project life cycle, where there is a good tension and a friction between project management office and the systems engineering, where everyone's really got that sense of tension early on of we need to get this thing organized and we need to get it on the road and we need to get things moving. And the systems engineers, to a certain extent, are the elastic band in between the two, because the project managers have got one end of the elastic band and they're off running down the road going, come on, come on, come on, let's get this thing organized, let's get it planned out. I've got this Gantt, I've got this idea, I've got these milestones, I've actually, you know, you guys aren't working quickly enough to plan this thing, so we've sketched out, you know, a framework for you to work within. And the systems engineers looking in the middle, looking at the engineers who are going, hey, I want five times as long to do this. And looking at the project managers who are saying, hey, this thing needed to happen yesterday. And then negotiating in both directions as to actually how to join the two things up, how to build the framework of organization between the guys that are actually going to do the work and the guys who are going to coordinate, and as you said, who are actually going to drive the sense of urgency into the delivery. And there is friction through that. You know, there's both tension and friction. And I enjoy it, and I respect it, because it's part of the ownership that you see across a well-functioning team early in a project lifecycle, where one person's going, hey, why don't we deliver it like this? And the other person's going, no, it can't work that way because this, that, the other. And that's how you figure it out. That's how you make it work. That's how you build the structure and the framework within which a successful project can be delivered. And it's interesting because in a way, the way I see it, the systems engineers and the project managers are both trying to drive the car. And to a certain extent, they're fighting over the wheel as to you know, what the directions. There's a bit of backseat driving going on. There's a bit of, you know, there's a bit of somebody trying to grab the wheel from the other side. There is actually a tension there, but that shows ownership and care about how to achieve success.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I think you pointed out that, you know, I've kind of presented a scenario where in a functioning team, time under tension is valuable, because a bit of discord, playing it out, a bit of scenario mapping is conducive to creativity. It's conducive to solutioning, and I think we appreciate that. And maybe we can flip it then and talk about the non-functioning piece and what drives that. So in your experience, like, now, what does a non-functioning culture look like, and how does that affect engineering particularly?
Well, in my experience, and I'll be interested to hear your views on this, but in my experience, a non-functioning culture frequently results to a mismatch of practice and process, or lack of familiarity, a lack of understanding how to make something work. I don't think I would put, you know, if a team or an organization get thrown out of their depth on a new challenge, I wouldn't call that non-functioning. You know, in a way, a challenge thrown at a team that can function, sure, you're going to have some failures, you're going to have some struggles, but I wouldn't call that non-functioning. I would say you throw a challenge into a team that can't function, and there's chaos. There's either disengagement or lack of ownership, or people individually taking ownership, which you often see, hero culture, and then a disengagement of key members, or there's an organizational problem where somebody is saying, I don't want these people to communicate with each other, or I want them to do this thing in this way, when actually they need to do it in a different way. So there's a number of different scenarios which are dysfunctional or non-functioning, but generally it relates to process and practice that aren't going to get it done. And either because they've not been formed, or they haven't got the experience, or because somebody's just set it up wrong and doesn't understand what you need to make something work. And I've had enough experience of that. Not going to go into specifics.
Come on.
But I've had enough. But I've had enough experience of that to see the difference, you know. And I think that's all of us who take pride in what we do in managing projects or participating in projects, it does take the experience of what doesn't work to really respect what does and how important it is.
Yeah, and I think the value comes from at least in my experience, a form of appreciation. So if you've got engineering in your background or in your blood, which I do, that you come, the mindset as well, being an engineer, it's the way you think about things, the way you think about life. I don't know how you see that. But you mechanize everything, and you can structurally unpack things and repack them. And it's a great format for any type of project management discipline, if you ask me. And we were talking to Tarag about recruitment, and he was saying, Dale, wasn't he, about how they prefer people with an engineering background, even in project controls. And I said, oh, that's interesting. I wonder why. And I think it's because of the mindset, although I don't have any data to back that. So, but, you know, from a project management perspective, I think best experience I've had with this is project managers who've done well with engineering teams are those that sit with engineering teams, rather than, not that there's this physical hierarchy, but there seems to be some type of virtual hierarchy where the project manager thinks they dominate the team. And they go away and decide what the future looks like, come back to the engineering team, as I said before, and say, right, this is the plan and you're meant to comply with it, even though you know the solution is going to take longer. And this is where the friction is unbalanced, I think, from a dysfunctional perspective. Have you had any experiences like that? And is there any way to overcome that for anyone listening who might be in that situation?
I think we all know that collaboration is more effective than trying to force people to do things without them understanding. I mean, engineers are one of the worst breeds of of project participants for being unwilling or uncomfortable to do anything that they don't understand. You try and get an engineer to do something that they don't understand the logic of, they will not follow it. They won't do it. And you get a whole bunch of outcomes of that, whether they're stress related, whether they're disengagement, whether they're just a complete lack of understanding. But you really do need to get buy-in when you're working with engineers to have a successful project delivery. So how do you get that? Well, I think when you say that project managers that sit with engineering teams are more successful, there are human aspects to dealing with engineers as well as developing a common understanding. There are matters of trust in any business that we do. And building respect, building trust, building a sense of leadership, building a sense of shared roles and responsibilities. If you don't spend time with people, those things don't necessarily happen. I think when you say sitting with engineering teams, I think we've also probably had each of us the experience where things have just gone so smoothly that you feel like you're sitting with a person even when you only spend half an hour a week with them, because you have that connection of communication and common thinking that actually you don't need to be sitting with them to be sitting with them. But that's rare. And most of the time you need to get, you need to build a common understanding, a common respect and a common trust to actually make something happen. Engineers are very often incredibly stubborn and need convincing that actually you merit them following you and you merit them actually working with you, which is you know, an interesting experience when you go into the trade or when you try and engage with a new person. There's a lot of human aspects to deal with frequently when you're working with, particularly when you're working with people who have developed huge pride, but also a deep knowledge of their subject. You know, they are they want to understand that they're dealing with somebody who is also bringing something to the party, and that does take collaborative values.
So it, summarizing from my view then, that you're saying that the more technical role, maybe the more human effort, you know, or the human interaction or whatever, human attitude, you know, an approachability that's required. So let's say there's a really technical part of ambiguous scope or ambiguous technical component, you should be spending a lot more time maybe as a project manager developing that relationship because you're going to have friction rather than disconnecting, if that makes sense.
I think the ambiguous scope aspect, which is another key element of systems engineering, I think the ambiguous scope element is actually more challenging, not from the human and respect aspect. It's actually about building the communication and effective communication, because very often the project manager or the systems engineer or, you know, the engineering or the business development part of the business or the contracting arm of the commercial arm of the business is the arm that have the contact with the customer, and the customer is saying some really vague things about what it is that they want, and the only person that can really provide insight as to what it is that they might possibly be talking about sometimes is the engineering team, or it's the engineering team together with the systems engineering team, together with the project manager, together with the business development, to try and get that communication working. And that is another challenge. You know, there's the human aspects I was talking about before, but the communication aspects, particularly when you're dealing with a very detailed person who doesn't necessarily have. We were talking earlier about the systems engineers being the glue between in the hierarchy of the project, and trying to translate a high level concept or what the high level concept might possibly be. You know, there might be a number of different things that could be interpreted as. The specific engineer, you know, the highly disciplined or not highly disciplined, definitely not highly disciplined, but highly detailed engineer, is most likely to latch onto the first thing that they think that could be. You know, they're not necessarily disciplined at thinking about all of the different possibilities there could be and all of the possible misunderstandings that there might be and all of the possible avenues that, you know, between a project manager and a systems engineer, you can actually flesh out and figure out how wrong this whole thing could go if we jump at shadows early on in the project. So you've got all of that, I want to broaden this whole thing out discipline at the front edge of the project where people are thinking how bad things could go. And then you've got the engineer who actually wants to home in on what it is that they're doing as soon as possible. And getting that communication and that trust or collaboration going in that environment can be quite difficult because you're pulling in different directions. You know, one person's trying to broaden it out and the others are trying to narrow it down. And then you get a bit further in your understanding the project and it switches around the other way. And the engineer wants to broaden it out and the project manager and the system engineer wants to narrow it down. And so this, you know, you can't do that unless you have that team, not only discipline and trust, but also team view. The team, I think Dale, as a rugby player, there you get to that discipline on a sports field where something happens and everybody looks at each other and there's this invisible communication that just goes, we know what just happened. We know what opportunity just got opened up. And actually, we know that we've switched into a different mode of work. And you don't have that unless you've got a finely tuned, well-functioning team. Okay, maybe there's a few words that go to and fro, or there's a hand gesture or two that go between the team, but the communication happens almost instantly and everybody knows, okay, well, my job now is I'm pulling in that direction and I'm going to go off and do this. And unless you get that efficiency of communication within a team, you can't switch around between seeing what the threat is, seeing what the opportunity is, and actually in a configuration going after it. And that doesn't come naturally to each of those members of the team necessarily until you've done it a couple of times. But then it doesn't come naturally to the highly detailed engineer, and it doesn't come naturally necessarily to the project manager to know how to communicate everything down to that discipline. But the systems engineer is given and trained with a number of possible ways or methodologies and techniques to try and organize that in a way that will actually build the bridge and make that collaboration between the project manager and the rest of the team possible. And I think that comes about the stuff that we were talking about earlier, where is it a case of what are we trying to achieve at the moment? Is it about communication? Is it about lining ourselves up onto the current aim of the project? Is it whatever? That's a really important bit of making a functioning team.
You got me thinking while you were talking there. I don't think I've ever seen a book that says the project manager's handbook to speaking to engineers. Nor that I've seen anything around. I mean, you'll take institute books or books of knowledge that project managers are trained. Maybe this is part of the problem with project managers is the way they're educated. Because obviously engineering is very structured when it comes to training and education. But when it comes to project management, I'm being flippant here, so I don't want to offend anyone, but no. Yeah, you're going to be offended either way. Project managers, I'm on your side. Don't worry. you know, I'm trying to understand. Like, this is something I think you bring it at a point, and the reason it's coming back and forth being repeated is because it's important. The fact that we need communication, the fact that we need to trust people. And I think one of the powers that project managers have in their tool belt, not many, one of them is delegation. So delegation properties, right? You, if you've got a system engineer who can broadly understand what's required to happen, can speak the language of engineers. If I was the project manager, you know, Tim, I'd be more than happy to work with you. Help get my point or my communication across to the engineering team and then get that feedback as well, which is really important. Do you know any good, is there any references out there for project managers, books, sites, tools other than Project Chatter, of course?
My recommendation, if anybody wants a very early dip into systems engineering, which is effectively where you will find that information that you were talking about. I'm sorry, NKC, but SEBOK is not my go-to. I find it quite hard to navigate. I go to the NASA Systems Engineering Handbook.
And NASA Systems Engineering Handbook, is that available online? Is it?
It's available for free online, with some resources in support of it, and some articles in support of it as well. There's quite a good sequence of articles that also. It's interesting because there's a big community that reference into the NASA Systems Engineering Handbook. And there are articles that discuss the trade-offs of various things. I had an amusing one dipping into Anadev for a second on a project the other day where I was encouraging people to develop a dialogue about project lifecycle so that we could get the right things done at the right points of a project. And it was quite funny because I pointed them at the NASA Systems Engineering Handbook and they said, yeah, we've been looking at that too. We totally agree with you. That's a good place to be focused. But I'd just like to draw your attention to this particular article. And I read the article and I came back and I said, there's one thing I took from that article you pointed me at, and it was to back off and let you get on with what you're good at. And he was like, yeah, you got the point.
Fantastic. That's great.
But that was great.
Sometimes the direct route's the best route, isn't it, Tim? But you brought up NKOSI. What does that stand for? What is NKOSI?
So systems engineering has developed over the years via various different threads and various different professional recognition or recognition of developing disciplines. And a lot of them go back into the days of US DOD investing very heavily in defense systems, particularly in the Cold War, and developing aeronautical solutions as well with you know, fighter jets and huge investments with the US government. And if you look back at systems engineering, you can find a bunch of standards that are referenced. There's a couple of articles that actually cross-refer all of the different standards that have been developed over the time and the disciplines, and saying this discipline looks at it this way and this standard looks at it the other way and this methodology looks at it the other. But as with project management and almost any professional discipline, accountants and architects, and you end up with an important part of holding together or developing best practice being institutions and being professional institutions and professional councils and professional accreditation bodies. And I couldn't tell you, because I haven't really gone back and taken the time to study the history of NKOSI, but NKOSI is an organization, is one of the leading organizations pushing the adoption of systems engineering in developing a focal center for that, and pushing to standardize and provide a professional forum for discussion of these disciplines. And there are two main arguments or two main particular affiliations. It's been too long since I went on my systems engineering course to tell you what the other was. But I was very, very lucky in the fact that our systems engineering course, which was actually focused around a US university, because we were working down low, working for a US defense contractor at the time, or a subsidiary thereof. And they had the reasons for why they did it is probably a bit sensitive, but it involved somebody dropping a very expensive satellite on the ground. There were some other massive overspends on some naval projects that the business suffered from, and they decided that they were going to go on a massive drive to train people in systems engineering. And so this is where the course came from that I was lucky enough to be given. But in trying to find a UK lecturer for the University of California, Irvine Extension. So it's a bit like the Open University. It was an extension university, a remote training where effectively the university sets the syllabus and then they find a local lecturer to give that course. So they needed to find somebody who was going to follow the syllabus and be able to train it out. And we were very lucky that through the avenues and I assume affiliations with Inkosi, we ended up with the local Inkosi person who also happened to be, I think at the time he was the director of engineering capability for Thales's training arm at the time. I don't know whether he's representative of Inkosi because I have had very little to do with Inkosi since. But the very holistic view that was taken in that course, and I think from what I have seen of Inkosi's documentation, but it's a bit hard to follow sometimes. It was a good approach to teaching our systems engineering because it was quite human, but it was also a very broad brush in terms of looking at it from a number of different disciplines, a number of different types of engineering, you know, whether they're civil engineering, whether they're electronic engineering, whether they're water engineering and mechanical engineering, you know, and I think from a project management point of view, that's important as well to remember that a project is a project, but actually there are many, many different things you could be working on. And Inkosi is useful in that it does that because it covers many, many disciplines from a systems engineering point of view. So I haven't necessarily done Inkosi credit in advertising them, but
no, it's just great to get your view because you mentioned it, and that's Inkosi spelled Incose, and the website's Inkosi.org, and that stands for, it's an acronym, it's the International Council on Systems Engineering. Is what it stands for. So I guess folks can go and Google that and check them out if they're interested, Tim. But thanks for giving the background on that. I just want to jump back to your bio. In your bio, you've got that you were thrown into a fairly stressful bid, but a very good learning opportunity, it says in your bio. And I'm assuming it was a defense bid, so we can't go into the details thereof. But if you could perhaps give some of the lessons that you learned, particularly from an engineering perspective, because we've had quite a few project managers on here, project controls people, PMO people, talking about the lessons they've learned, particularly when there's been stressful, chaotic projects or bid processes. But from an engineering standpoint, was there anything that you can share with the listeners?
I think it really, what that bid really drove home to me was how useful structure is when you've been taught it. If you get thrown into the deep end of trying to estimate or trying to plan something, and you know you feel like you're sinking in just a disorganized mess of uncertainty, and you know you don't know what to grab a hold of and what to pull on to actually start to pull it into order, you find that you rely on some of the frameworks and some of the structure that you've been taught. And I didn't, to be honest, I'm not sure I did that instinctively, but I was pointed at it by the head of systems engineering for the company that I was working for at the time. We did have a little support in that project. And the support, I mean, we had some very good support from some specific individuals. We also lacked some major support in other areas, which is what made it very stressful. But the support that I did have reminded me to rely on frameworks and to rely on building up structure. And once you start to build up structure, you then find that you've got some things that you can hold on to and you can actually start building, even if you have to go back and rebuild the stuff that you started building. you find that you've actually got something that you can look at and work from. You know, you have to start somewhere.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is quite important. It's that framework, right? It's the rules of the game type thing that everyone's kind of playing towards the same, the same set of guidance. That's really interesting. But talking about guidance, rules, structure, I'm interested in this marriage of methodologies, systems engineering methodology and project management methodologies. I mean, the one that springs to mind, I know the others, is, you know, the V model in systems engineering. And then you bring into the likes of Agile or Waterfall. Yeah. Are there similarities or do they butt heads a lot, those various methodologies?
I think this is where the dialogue between project management and systems engineering is really lively and needs to be and is good early on in the project. And it's not necessarily early on in the project. And there's a couple of things that I was going to bring up through today, which we can come back to. But the this whole thing about, is it V, is it Agile, is it Spiral? There's a particular thing which I really like in actually the UK defense standard for combat systems engineering, which was really funny because I was having been on the NCOSI course and having learned about V models and having learned about Spiral in my previous time learning software engineering, and learning about Agile on systems engineering course as well, I started sort of waving my hands around on a particular project and saying, you know, we're kind of somewhere between a spiral and a V on this one. You know, we kind of need to be V-ing and spiraling at the same time. And then I opened up the defense standard and there was this picture of a spiral around a V. And I was like, okay, there you go. Somebody's, you know, explaining this whole thing, which is the good thing about Agile and the good thing about, there's good things about Agile, there's good things about Spiral. And that is, you can, and this has been described by people as the weakness of Waterfall model in the past, which is you frequently need to block up a project into a number of milestones. You frequently need to, because you've got a limited end date. You've got a limited date, and you have to try and stick some pegs in the ground and say, well, we're going to reach a level of maturity by these dates, full stop. If we don't do it, it's a failure. Yeah. And you know, and I know that there are certain things that you need to reach a level of maturity on at those points. But you also know that you're likely to have risks and uncertainties remaining at those dates. And the really tricky thing is how to juggle resolving which uncertainties, when and how, while you've got some rigid structures in the project saying, actually, the bulk of what we're doing is just going to be moving from this level of uncertainty or this level of this level of maturity, this level of detail, to that level of detail over this phase. And then you know that you've got two or three things that could completely undermine everything because there are uncertainties and there are risks involved. And this is where you end up effectively juggling between the Agile, the Spiral, the V, the Waterfall, and actually trying to interplay those different things with each other, and to a certain extent trying to firewall people off from the fear and uncertainty that those things hold, because you know that you've got to build the traction in the team to actually build up the structure of what can be known and what is known and what can be evolved to the next level of detail without undermining their faith and their confidence to do that by constantly coming back to these things that aren't answered. And that's one of the real challenges that I enjoy between these different models that you're talking about. And as a systems engineer, I very much feel a responsibility for making that workable and actually working with a project manager to find a solution to that interplay. Yeah. It's a nice game, and it's a nice argument. Particularly because when you're doing those things, you take the tenets of Agile, which basically say, I'm going to get very mature on a few details very early in my project. I'm actually going to take some of the things that somebody wants delivered, and I'm actually going to just deliver them early. I'm just going to take them to full fruition and actually deliver them early, and then incrementally build things on top of that. And then you've got people running around saying, you can't possibly jump into solution space right now. You're supposed to be working in problem space as a systems engineer. And you say, well, no, that's not actually true, because I think that I know how to solve that particular problem, but I'm really not confident that I do. So I'm going to build a little simulator. I'm going to build a little isolated island of the solution, and I'm going to go away and test to see whether I actually know that little detail works. Why am I going to do it? Well, I'm going to do it because I've got this flaming massive risk on my project that if I don't do that by stage three of the project, it's going to consume us all. And I really enjoy those arguments between those different methodologies.
That's really interesting, because I think a lot of our guests and listeners particularly come from the infrastructure and construction space. And what you're bringing in is another dimension where you got software, electronics, hardware components, and how it all has to play together. And on those types of development projects, there are a lot of unknowns. And uncertainty is what you're referring to, but it's interesting. You mentioned the combination of spiral and V model. Is that maybe perhaps viral? I'm not sure. Yeah,
very topical,
very appropriate. Yeah, yeah, very appropriate,
very appropriate. But spiral, what is that? I mean, I haven't come across it. I understand V. I've heard of that before. Obviously, agile and waterfalls have been spoken about quite a lot. What is spiral?
The idea of spiral is something that I believe originates in a software engineering discipline, and it probably does trace back to debate in the cohort of people who ended up driving agile, and it basically, the idea of spiral is that you go through a number of phases, a number of steps where you go from problem space to solution space and verification space. It's similar to V in the sense that when you're doing your V model and you're looking across your V and you're saying, what is my top level problem? And you then look across and say, well, how do I visualize my top level problem being solved? How do I demonstrate that my top level problem is solved? And then you come back to your top level problem and you say, do I understand my top level problem? In a way, it's like that, but it's kind of the opposite. You were talking about in a previous blog, you were talking about turning earned value management upside down with one of your
Simon White
guests. Yeah. And in a way, spiral's the other, because you're a bit like agile. You're actually saying, I'm possibly going to start small and then build up the complexity. Or you're actually challenging me to think about it, but I think it probably is actually, as I said, like the V model, where you start off at the high level, going backwards and forwards from what a solution looks like. The software engineering model, I mean, this comes back to some of the rational concepts and some of the UML and the modeling concepts, where you build a solution at high level in your abstraction, and you actually make it work. You know, you actually build something that functions, and you come out with an article, with an actual deliverable that actually is pretending to be what you're going to deliver to somebody. It's very low complexity, and it's quite high level, but it actually works. And there's some interesting games that you could have seen engineers playing, pretending to be an interface, for example. I don't know. I think you worked on a project, Dale, with some of our friends and colleagues, where they kind of invented or pretended that an interface between two pieces of equipment were some people having a conversation, and they used that as an analogy to actually figure out what the dialogue between two bits of equipment should be. It added a bit of fun to the project, sure. But it also solved some problems of, you know, just, and some of this is just high level design documentation where you draw what in systems engineering we'd be very familiar with, or in software engineering very familiar with, where you're just drawing some transactional diagrams of what happens between two pieces of equipment at either end of an interface, and one of them is just going, hi, is anybody there? Yeah, I'm here. Well, who are you? I'm Sunset. Well, what are you? Well, I'm one of these. Oh, right. Okay. Well, what can you do for me? And you know, this kind of stuff, which is high level modeling, to just visualize and get written down some of what you expect to happen before you actually get into the, well, what's the language that's being used? You know, what is the programming language? Mm-hmm. What operating system am I working on? You know, there's a huge range of different layers of complexity with an interface, but you start off with the, hi, how's it going? Yeah, it's all right. I'm working today. You know, that kind of stuff. And I think Spiral is very much around that kind of concept, where you start off at a high level and you go from problem space to solution space, and then you check to see whether how your compliance is working. And this is where the amusing V spiral was that was in the combat system engineering, because, you know, you're actually going through problem space and solution space at the high level of the V, and then it has an unfortunate look in a naval systems engineering manual of an aircraft wildly spiraling out of control about to crash land in the ocean. But that's what it looks like, a drawing in the handbook. But it did a reasonable job of communicating those quadrants that you go through.
Yeah, no, thanks for clarifying that. And perhaps, Val, you know, Tim's example there of sort of, you know, prototyping, if we can call it that, using people's conversations. Lends itself to actually software can fall into the 4D space. I don't know if you remember we threw that one out there. maybe you can do 4D modeling on software projects, Val. But I don't know. Any thoughts from your side, Val?
I was just thinking, actually. I was trying to mechanize, and I think prototyping is a really good point. You know, like, it lends itself a little bit to design thinking, which is the same thing. You know, it's human-centric problem solving, using prototyping as a way to bring people together without necessarily having the full solution solved. But it's about bringing the right elements of people to the party and then circulating what can and what cannot work and trying to find the limits of that system. I'm wondering then, from a estimation perspective, you mentioned uncertainty before.
Yeah.
And one of the things, you know, I have a team project at the moment, and I flip back and forth, but because, like, you make really good points, but from a project perspective, then you go, okay, as a project manager, Tim, you've got to estimate this piece of work, and you've got a whole bunch of really intelligent engineers, system engineers with you. How do you do it? I mean, there's a few layered questions in this, but is there a system that system engineers go to that they plan out system engineering stuff? Or is it more of a, let's remove as much ambiguity and uncertainty as possible, but we still don't know where end is roughly? Like, is there some science behind that, or how would you go about that as a project manager?
I think I've been doing a lot of this recently. I've got some projects, multidisciplinary projects, too many actually being planned at the moment and being trying to work out schedules. And I think there's a number of things that we've talked about today that come into play. One of them is either experience or trust in structures, in frameworks, in terms of what does an engineering project lifecycle look like? What are the phases? Just you know, checklist mentality. What are the things that I could do to look at phasing of a project? Yeah. There's the disciplines that as project managers and systems engineers will be very familiar with, about risk assessment mentality, which is a parallel thread. It's, let's go and figure out all the things that we do know, and then let's go and sit in a different room and work out all of the things that we've just assumed are going to go fine, but actually probably aren't. Let's just, you know, change the paradigm and go and look at that. So those are two things that are very important, is looking at the ideal case and then looking at all of the things that might go wrong, while looking at a number of different concepts for delivering the project. You know, which particular set piece are we going to play on this particular project? And a really, really important part is what we've been talking about today, which is going and having the dialogue as to how to resolve those uncertainties. because you can completely replan your whole project once you look at it that way.
Yeah.
Once you actually have been through the ideal best case based on some standard life cycles, gone and done your risk management piece and figured out some of the key risks, probably go and do some design, you know, some wild, crazy, wacky design stuff about, you know, trade-offs and counter types and prototypes and the wacky ideas and all the good, you know, innovation stuff that you can bring into this just to try and think out of the box a little bit, and then go and replan your project, thinking about the strategy that you're taking to plan your project. And it's a very uncomfortable room to be in, that one, because you've just torn up all of the work that you've done in the other three rooms, you know, put the pieces on the, but then you, when you realize that you can just kind of tear the bits of paper out and stick them in different orders and actually reorder them, you realize that actually everyone in the room suddenly becomes a lot more comfortable than they were when they came into the room, and everyone's sort of breathing a sigh of relief. But the other thing that you've got to bake into there, which is something that you brought up, is there will still be uncertainty. So how do we still cater for uncertainty? And this is one of the pieces that's come up on a couple of projects with me recently, which is an interesting one, where we plan to have, on many of the projects I'm working on, we plan to have deliberately two spins of a particular hardware design, because we know that we're going to learn things that we're going to have to restitch in. One of the really interesting things is that the first spin of your hardware might give you something that you can actually build software on. It might give you an opportunity to prototype, to integrate a prototype system. Yeah. And that is a huge opportunity to actually start integrating your prototypes together and solving some of the problems of integration early. But one of the big uncertainties is it might not. Yeah. And so you've got this whole branch of integration opportunity of software development that is on a knife edge until like several weeks before you're actually supposed to start the work. And not only that, on some of the developments we've been running recently, is the hardware team are also on a knife edge, because if they deliver you a set of hardware that you can actually integrate on, actually, to be honest, you completely lose interest in what they're doing for months on end, because you go, guys, you know, I'm done with hardware for now. I've got a hardware platform I can build on. I'm going in the other room and I'm going to play around with software, and you guys could just crack on with whatever you want to do. But that decision doesn't get made until weeks or even possibly days before that, you know, that uncertainty doesn't get resolved until that time. And there's possibly man years of work that are going to move by a number of months just on that one outcome. And this is a really interesting challenge for me, which I have not got an answer to at the moment, because it's kind of the coal face of my professional maturity. If I haven't got to this point before and turned it into a stock solution, you know, and I think that's one thing that we build up in our careers, is we build up a set of stock solutions that actually you go into a project and you go, hey, it could go like this or it could go like that. We'll stitch this in early, and we have the experience to do that. But I'm kind of at that point now, and none of us have got, you know, none of us have on the project have got the answers to this, but we're negotiating it, and it's a very interesting place to be. So
yeah,
I guess the message there is, it doesn't matter how much you try to plan for uncertainty. It doesn't matter how much you bake uncertainty into your estimates and your plans. There's some stuff where you just have to plan for the fact that you know there's a key branch and a key decision point, and it's either going to go one way or it's going to go the other, and everyone's just got to be on standby for the answer.
Yeah, I guess it's like using your car analogy before. Regardless of how safe or how competent you are at driving the car, or who's driving the car, you know, a branch could fall off and hit the road in front of you at any point in time. I know Dale uses a lot of car analogies, but that's a good response. One of the things I wanted to say, though, as well, was, is there something that machines can do to help us? I mean, I once worked on a project with Dale as well, and I was working in the bid scene, and I mapped out the DDQS, the V lifecycle, and I looked at these two streams, the hardware and the software, and then how they got to technical readiness review. And I was like, they kind of don't hold hands always at the same time. So how do they get to that TRR? And then And then there was a bit of a breakdown in my mind of how that would work in reality. And obviously I was just doing a bit of a theoretical academic exercise. So for me as a kind of project controls guy, I didn't really get into the detail, but I could see, I could appreciate there'd be some uncertainty around the software element and the hardware integration, which you mentioned, especially if it's a complex system, which they usually are. The other thing I was thinking was there, yeah, back to my point, is there something that machines could help with? Like, we've got all this automation, we're all buzzing about this digital era, Industry 4.0 and all that. Is there anything we can do to help systems engineers?
I think that if you look at what impact machines are having on systems engineering, and I'm, you know, this is kind of nebulous in a way, but I think it's true, is systems engineers are actually, I've been keen on Agile for a while. And I think that problem that I just posed, which is what happens if you don't know what you're going to be doing a few weeks ahead at a particular juncture of a project? Well, one way to do that, to deal with that, is to get used to not knowing what you're going to be doing a few weeks in advance and building the mechanisms and methodologies that it doesn't matter that you don't know what you're going to be doing a few weeks in advance. And a lot of that is associated with Agile methodologies. The fact that we build the networks of communication, the IT infrastructures, the IT tools that we actually trust to be able to pick up and put down different bits of projects without that assumed flow of inheritance. Because I think that's the key bit about why we get so het up about dependencies and flows of projects. It's got a lot to do with human memory. It's got a lot to do with what's fresh in your mind and, you know, what are you warmed up to do? What just flows from one piece to the next? And one of the real challenges that you have is if you have to put down a whole bunch of threads and go off and solve another problem and then come back and pick those threads back up again. It's got a similar aspect of, you know, the inefficiency of trying to multitask a team on multiple projects, for example. It's a similar thing with the efficiency. And actually machines are helping us in that, in the sense of the IT tools, the move towards agile techniques where actually building a collective project consciousness within databases, within action registers, within a visualization of where you are and how things depend on each other and what the questions remaining are and where the answers lie. That really helps us to pick up and put down projects to have those tools and methodologies. So I think that's kind of it's not really possibly the answer that you were after in sense of what can machines do for us.
Yeah.
But it's where we see computing being a key asset in what is fundamentally, in many cases for us as a human experience of working on a project. How do you remove some of the issues of humanity and you know, constraints of humanity? And one of the key things, it's one of the reasons that I've been successful in my career is because I have an incredible memory for highly detailed matter, which is one of the reasons you have to listen to me talk as much as you do. but I'm very often relied upon within the team. I become very central within teams for actually just remembering what the hell we're doing and why we're doing it. And that is a huge constraint in projects, that memory constraint that humans have. And IT really does help.
That's a good point you raise. So what you're saying, I play it back, is that if we created a Tim Ackland database with the retrieve and recall function, that would be a billable product that we could go out to market with. Dale, we've got a product, perfect. We need to build almost like a memory, a mnemonic system basically in a machine that would allow people to access the information as they needed it, rather than just working on the flashiest thing that comes up. That's a really interesting point. I was just commenting, you know, I was in my head a little bit. And the other thing was, I think the other issue is we have to let go of waterfall, and my project managers now might be freaking out. And this is from the engineering perspective, but I think from their perspective, that it's like going down a staircase with a waterfall, exactly how it's going. You're not going down a staircase. And what we're saying here is, what we're not going to tell you where the next step is coming from. You're walking down the stairs and then suddenly the stair in front of you disappears. That makes project managers and executives very, very nervous. And obviously clients at some point. And then what's worse is you could come back with a wooden step or a step made out of paper plates or paper airplanes, depending where the engineers go with Agile. You might eventually come back to a normal stair, but this is one of the things that I guess Agile hasn't truly convinced people of. It hasn't convinced project management as a mass that it's the unified theory. And I think we asked this, I think I asked this last pod as well, Dale. Is there a unified theory for project delivery? Answer is no, because you can do it and it depends. And people say that it depends on the situation or the type of work and the client and the system engineers. But I haven't found anything, and please, Tim, tell me if you have, something that would bring everything together. And I'm hoping at some stage machines will definitely help. I think that's true. But I don't think there's a unified theory as such yet that's convinced everybody.
I think that you talk about convincing everybody. And we talked earlier about the human aspects of getting people convinced to buy in to working within a team and working in a particular hierarchy or a particular organizational model within a team. And to a certain extent, one way to avoid that is not having to convince people, And I think in a way, that's what you're saying. If you can eliminate the human aspects of making the decisions, that makes things a lot easier. Because, if you don't have to convince people, then, you're getting dangerously close to the cyborg here, to the Borg of people just forced to have a collective consciousness that they don't have a choice but to integrate with.
I've got an Elon Musk side. I've got to turn it down sometimes. And
yeah, I thought we'd go this whole pod without mentioning it, but there we go.
Yeah, it's too late. In there now.
But I think as long as humans are involved, actually the shortcoming is not having enough discussion.
Mm.
Getting people to engage with the philosophy of what you're doing and why you're doing it. The problem that we have at the moment, I think, and I say at the moment, it's not at the moment, it's a problem we've been having for generations, and it is particularly strong in the past period that I've been working in engineering, is models and methodologies become jargon, and they just become jargon. They become people spouting a load of words to kind of look like or sound like they know what they're talking about. There is a risk that you fall into that convincing people becomes just convincing people that you know what you're talking about and they should listen to you and they should just do what you say. That's not the right way to get effective organizational success. Yeah. Actually getting people engaged and bought in enough to be interested in why you're doing something a particular way and then actually get them to ask the questions as to, how are you actually going to solve my problems by the way that we're doing things? That's, I think, the way that you then get things to run more smoothly. Sometimes you can't have the dialogue, and sometimes, in certain organizations, I'm not going to repeat the particular phrase, but in my business, there used to be a culture which was just do it. That actually there was no space for questions and answers. There was no space. And actually, for a while, it produced more productivity in the business than engaging with people, because at least people were doing stuff. There weren't any questions being asked. I'll tell you what, the quality that came out was an interesting legacy, but stuff got done. Didn't get done particularly well, and people weren't bought in, and people got disengaged. Some people did. Some people loved it because they just got on and did some work and they felt productive and they felt some satisfaction out of that. But I don't think that goes very far. And I think actually engaging with people and understanding what their concerns and problems are is an important part to play in getting organizational productivity. And you say, is there a tool for convincing people? I think it becomes a role within a project and it becomes a role within an organization. And I think systems engineering is partly aligned with that. It's about trying to produce that picture, that image. You very often see, block diagrams and, flow of sequence of events and a whole bunch of different graphical representations of systems or processes or whatever. That's the job of a systems engineer. You go and ask a bunch of other people within the organization to draw some pictures, and they'll draw you some pictures, and there'll be a whole bunch of people scratching their heads going, what's that? What's that trying to represent? And if you've got a good systems engineer, they will come and look at the picture and hear what people are saying, and they'll go next door and they'll come back 10 minutes later and they'll draw you another picture that everyone goes, okay, I got it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's about communicating a whole bunch of concepts and ideas efficiently in a way that is almost, I think said earlier, unambiguous as well, or it's less ambiguous. And I think that's an important bit about getting joined up about what you're trying to achieve and how you're going to achieve it and why that's the right way to do it. It just got a lot to do with communication.
Yeah, I agree.
That's great. Hey Dale, that might bring you to 4D planning, model-based planning then.
Exactly.
I'm going to have to look up this 4D thing because I'm sorry, I haven't been watching enough of your material to have followed that thread.
We'll send you a link, mate.
We'll send you a link. It's mainly around construction or physical projects. It'd be interesting because I threw the question out there to the guys when we had them on, and I said, can this 4D modeling be extended into software projects? I mean, nah, only in the physical world, but you're using the prototyping of two people talking to each other, simulating, code, perhaps could be 4D modeling, who knows? It's interesting. You bring up, the JFDI concept, and there's a time and place for JFDI, but not always.
Hang on, what's JFDI? What is that?
I just fucking do it.
But you're not familiar with this concept, Al?
I have. I think Dale taught me when I got to the UK. My introduction.
It's not sustainable, as you say, Tim. So it's not something that should be encouraged. But you talk about discussion, and I love the fact that you bring that up because this is one of the reasons we have the pod. It's one of the reasons we've got you on. And also, you threatened to give us one-word answers, and thank goodness you didn't.
No.
Thank goodness you didn't, because I think we've got such a lot out of you, and I think we could continue, for hours and hours chatting. But just as we head towards the end of the pod, I've got one final question for you from myself. And I know you're a man after my own heart and you love a bit of whiskey. What's your favorite tipple, your go-to currently?
Oh, my current go-to tipple. And does it have to be within whiskey?
No, it can be anything.
I have a I was into tequila for a while, and I am still quite into tequila. I like a bit of a mezcal, but in the cupboard at the moment there's one bottle that is surviving because I can't drink it quickly just because I want to make it last, and it was a bottle of Calvados that I bought just before my 40th birthday, and it's 40 it's made the year that I was born.
Wow.
And I got it in Normandy on a trip with my now wife, and that's it's pretty satisfying stuff, I have to say. Yeah,
and that's probably what helped the moustache grow, I guess. But no, Tim, I want to thank you for your time. Honestly, appreciate it. Too. The insight, the opinions, the thoughts. It's really amazing and engaging. If I can just backtrack, there's so much we spoke about, but systems engineering, there's a lot of methodologies. Go and have a look at what it is all about. Spiral, something brand new that we've heard about. I certainly haven't. Maybe there's others that have heard about it. So really interesting stuff there. But as we head into the final section of the pod, Tim, are there any final thoughts that you want to leave our listeners with?
As always, I have done a lot of talking, and I'm kind of sad that I didn't get to hear more of your perspective on systems engineering. So shame I failed to do that. Do you have a couple of minutes to say what you think the role of systems engineers is in projects and how valuable it is?
Sure. I'll give my quick take. I love a sports analogy, right? And that's how I'm going to put it. So when you were chatting and describing what a systems engineer was, for me, if you took, you know, often you get sports teams these days that have international coaches, and sometimes they don't speak the language, right? And you have an interpreter. But the systems engineer is not just the interpreter. It's actually someone that understands the game as well. And if you have a really shit interpreter, guess what? The team aren't going to understand what the coach wants to do, right? So that's how important that role actually is, because here comes in this coach or this project manager who speaks a totally different language, and the team has to understand what that strategy is and what they have to do to be successful. So that interpreter role in that sports team analogy comes crucial. So that's my analogy, Val.
Yeah, I see them actually very similar to project controls, where if you think my analogy back or my terms as engineers are doers, project managers are movers, project controls are integrators, and I think system engineers are the same. So we're trying to get everyone to hold hands and play well and then understand. I like the game analogy as well, Dale. You stole it though, so I can't use that. But for the system engineering projects that I've been on, I've always found that the project controls, or at least the PMO elements, worked really well with system engineering. And then they kind of worked as a bit of an alliance to help influence other stakeholders, particularly project managers, who would rather trade everything else for time or sometimes cost. And engineers would return with, well, here's the reasons why you shouldn't trade that one out of the triangle, because obviously it affects quality. And it can affect cost. If we're rushing through it, we're going to have a lot of rework. So I kind of see them as an alliance and as an integrator for the engineering team. And, you know, if there was unions, not that there are many anymore, particularly in Australia, but they're kind of unionizing engineering as some form of representation, because they understand the deep requirements. As you said, they go in, whereas project managers don't. Maybe they do. But at least the consensus is they don't. They're looking at the end goal, and that's why they love Waterfall so much.
Yeah.
So I see them as this introspection of the project that give you an insight that you may not have had before. And if the idea of projects is that data has to be accurate so that people who deliver projects can make informed decisions, then the system engineer is critical to that process for me. Mm. So that's how I see them. I've done a few defense projects as well.
I think you've brought some really important, valuable points up there. I think that was a really good way of putting it, particularly your sort of analogy of unionizing. They both hold the project manager to account, but also in getting multidisciplinary views respected and represented in that forum. And to a certain extent, they hold the keys and the crown jewels to make the systems to make the engineering team work together, so they've got currency that they can negotiate with.
Correct. Yeah,
and
I was being nice about it, but yeah, but they can hold the project ransom effectively if they wanted to. You know,
they could, but that gives them a lever.
Correct. Yeah,
and the language analogy I think I like as well, because I think this is where the fact that I studied abroad for 2 years really helps me, and I lived abroad for some time, because when you're trying to translate between different languages for somebody, you're not just translating language, you're translating culture. And that's part of that piece as well, is actually to see things from different perspectives and with a different context. Yeah.
Yeah. Really well put.
We're all translators then, it looks like.
Exactly. Exactly.
This has been really interesting. It's been, an opportunity to talk a lot. Sorry about that. That's been useful to somebody. But to hear the end of that from both of you summing up was interesting and good. I'm glad we got to do that at the end.
Yeah. No, thank you, Tim. And appreciate all of your thoughts. That's the whole point of a pod, is for you to talk. So
exactly.
Yeah, but I wanted to get something out of it as well.
Of course.
Val, any final thoughts from yourself?
Oh, you caught me just drinking water. No, I think, you know, don't be too hard on yourself, Tim. I think it was really good, insightful. You know, you went comprehensive, which is great because a lot of the people who listen could be system engineers or interested in engineering discipline. I know we kind of encourage STEM discussion and we don't get enough of them on the pod. So thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Cheers. Thanks, Phil. Well, folks, that's all we have time for in this episode, but it doesn't have to stop here. Subscribe to our YouTube channel for bonus bits and our website for a link to our online community with all our expert guests. Support our charities and access blogs and previous podcasts at projectchatterpodcast.com. A big thanks to our guest, Tim Ackland. Thank you all for listening. Hit subscribe so you don't miss the next one. Until then, we say stay safe, be disruptive, and have fun doing it. From me and Val, it's bye for now. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the participating individuals and not necessarily to the individual's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual. Additionally, any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual.